you know, imposter syndrome is a hell of a drug. And so it's kind of like, what do you, you know, where do you fit in? And the thing is, if you write, you are a writer. That's it.
Welcome to Beyond the Fourth Wall of Writing with your host, John Robinson IV. Here we smash walls, demolish writer's block, and learn how to harness the true power of storytelling. Let's get started. Kaylin Bayron is the New York Times bestselling author who debuted in 2020 with her young adult fantasy, Cinderella is Dead. She excels at retelling and reimagining old stories, mythology, and legends as new powerful stories about culture, resistance, and perseverance. What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Beyond the Fourth Wall of Writing podcast. I'm your host, John Robinson IV, and today with me, I have Kaylin Bayron. What's going on?
Hey, thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. So recently, I'd read, finally, I've been looking at them for a while, but I finally read This Poison Heart and This Wicked Face, Fate. Yeah, I love them. I'm kind of mad I didn't read them before. I don't know. I'm not sure what it is that stood out for me the most. I don't know if it was the mythology or if it was the. I like stories that are like current day, but have like this air of mysticism to it, and it kind of like takes you on a journey into not necessarily the past, but like kind of through history or whatever.
Yeah, I love those stories too. I'm very much into kind of a modern setting or a contemporary setting that has this kind of undercurrent of history, hidden history, that's always fascinating to me.
Right. I really like what you did in this story. There's so many elements. I'm gonna try to be careful not to spoil some of the elements because there's a lot of cool. Because when you first pick up the book, you know, you see the amazing cover and you see the girl and you see the plants and you're like, okay, cool. There's maybe some magical stuff going on with plants. But there's so much more. There's so much more than what the cover shows. So I'll be careful on like what I expose. But that being said, I usually do like to start off asking kind of a icebreaker question, which is dealing with writing advice. So there's, you know, there's two ways like to pose this question. First, is there any writing advice that you want to impart to people? Or is there the funner part of the question is there any writing advice that you profoundly disagree with and why?
Oh man. So I think probably most writing advice, I would encourage people to take it with a grain of salt. Not everything works for everybody, but my favorite piece of writing advice is from Toni Morrison. And she did an interview one time where she said that a problem that a lot of writers encounter is that they can't identify their own bad writing. And she says the problem is first to know when you're not writing well and then to be able to fix it. Right. I think at some point you have to be critical enough to identify problems within your own writing and then be really honest with yourself about how you mean to fix those issues. And I think that is a wonderful piece of advice because we don't want to be so overly critical that we kind of get in our own way. But allowing yourself to look at the work critically and make improvements that's what writing is about. That's what being a writer and improving your craft is about. So I think that's a really solid piece of advice. The advice that I don't like is you have to write X amount of words every day.
Oh yeah.
You know, like 2,000 words or 1,500 words or whatever it is. I can't do that. I just know I have to write when it works for me. And I have to write as much as I need to. And that number changes from day to day. So, you know, anybody who's kind of telling you have to write 2,000 words a day in order to be a writer, that's not true. You don't have to listen to that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I like that. I like that advice. I actually had DJ Older.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I had DJ Older on the podcast, and oh, he's a huge proponent of like, you know, self-care and look, you're a writer. If you stop writing for 2 months and come back, you're a writer. If you stop writing for a year and come back writing, you're still a writer. And I love that he put it like that, because some people really do get discouraged in terms of like, am I still a part of this community? Am I still, right. You know, am I valid in this group? Like, can I call myself a writer if I didn't write, you know, and I mean, I deal with that sometimes. I'm like, man, sometimes I'm like, I go like days without writing, and I'm just like, man, I'm doing writing podcasts and writers chats every week, and I'd be slacking, you know?
Yeah, no, it's, yeah, you know what? I think it's a universal kind of feeling, because even, you know, even this far into my writing journey, there are still days where I feel like, am I enough to be a part of this kind of larger community with all of these really amazing, creative people? It's, you know, imposter syndrome is a hell of a drug. And so it's kind of like, what do you, you know, where do you fit in? And the thing is, if you write, you are a writer. That's it. Yeah. And sometimes it can be that simple. Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah. I really like that. Like, so many people think like that. I there seems to be far less people who are critical and, you know, who are saying, write every day, blah, blah. I mean, I know that there's something, yeah, I've seen some.
There's always some. Yeah. There's always some. Yeah.
But it does seem like, I do feel like the most important thing is to be honest with yourself. If you feel like, you know, like, hey, I know that I should be writing more than once a week or whatever, or I know that I'm not being consistent or something like that, that you could be honest with yourself, but not to the point where you're beating yourself up. You know, you right. don't want to, you know, be so critical that you're just, you know, putting yourself into like depression or anything like that. That's right. not necessary. Yeah.
Right. And it slows down the process too. Sometimes when you're overly critical, especially very early in your writing, you know, if you're drafting, that is the point in time to be critical of anything. That is the point to, right. you know, that's the point where you're throwing everything on the page. You're putting all the ideas down. Mm-hmm. You can fix it later. But right. yeah, being really overly critical at that very early drafting stage can really stall your progress.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So I want to also ask about, since we're talking a little bit about the drafting stage and stuff like that. Or I guess this is a step before the drafting stage. When you are coming up with like story ideas and stuff like that, and you're trying to figure out like what, you know, all these ideas and stuff you may have, how do I form this into a coherent story, and what am I going to focus on? What does that process usually look like for you? Do you start with multiple ideas and put them together, see what sticks, or do you usually have a concrete thing that you have written down in, you know, like a story journal or something, or what does that look like?
Yeah, So I'll just use This Poison Heart as an example. That book is, I like to describe it sometimes as Little Shop of Horrors meets The Secret Garden with a Greek mythology twist. And the reason that it's all of these, like, those things don't have anything to do with each other. It seems like the most random things ever, but I love musical theater. So I love Little Shop of Horrors. I loved the Secret Garden movie that came out in like the early 90s. And I love Greek mythology, and I wanted to put all of those things together. So for me, coming up with the ideas is really about just kind of collecting experiences over my lifetime. And kind of usually for me, the world comes first versus the characters. And so for me, it was really about, you know, what happens if maybe you inherit an estate and there's a secret garden? And what if, you know, the plant from Little Shop of Horrors is in the garden and not, you know, just some pretty flowers? Like, you know, that's kind of how my process works. It's just kind of what if. It's a lot of what if questions that pop up right at the beginning. And I love to kind of step outside of the lines of genre, because I feel like that can be very limiting sometimes. So I like to pull in all of the things that I feel are important and fun and interesting for a story to kind of take shape. And then that's when I start outlining, because I work from an outline, and that process is messy for me. It's so messy. I have tried really hard over the past few years to kind of make that routine more kind of cohesive. And but it's mm-hmm. I'm always learning, it's always changing. So
I think that's good for people to hear too, because there's certain, sometimes you read writing books or something like that, and the book will have a very like very rigid, you know, beat by beat by beat, make sure you do this, your inciting incident, your rising act, your whatever.
Right.
And then if people feel like they're missing those things, they're kind of like, oh, why I can't continue the story because I don't have this beat number 28 out of 100 or whatever, you know? Right. and I think knowing that there's a million different ways to come at the writing process helps people know, realize that it is really more, it's more of a, I don't know, things start to, like, when you're writing, things come together differently every time. It's never the same, you know?
Every time. And it's something that I didn't completely expect. I thought, okay, I wrote Cinderella is Dead just chapter by chapter. I didn't work from an outline with that story. I just wrote as far ahead as I could kind of think. And then I went back and did a huge revision. But with my next book, I was on a deadline. I had, like, there were new kind of circumstances, and I was like, okay, I need to figure out a different way to do this. So let me do the outline. So it's kind of like, okay, you know, you pick up these things, and I love craft books. So I read a lot of craft books, and I'm always picking up new things to try, just to try and make my process better and to make the work better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, and I think those, like, craft books, I love pulling bits and pieces of ideas from those books. Like when I was talking about like the beach process, I was kind of over exaggerating Save the Cat a little bit. And Save the Cat is one of those books where I definitely think that you should read the book. Like, I think that's a good book to read, but I definitely also would say, do not listen to like most of the stuff in that book.
Right.
It's like, but it's, there's so much good stuff in there, but like, how rigid it is. He does actually mention in the book that you don't have to be that rigid, but the way that it's structured, it makes you think in that way, you know?
Right, right. We have to be really careful about kind of pulling out the things that really work for us and our individual processes, mm-hmm. and the way our brain works, because I'm all over the place. So I have, there's this other craft, I love Save the Cat, but there's this other craft book called Wonder Book, by Jeff Vandermeer. And mm-hmm. it's much more, it's visual, and there's pictures, and that's kind of how my brain works as well. So I'm picking apart those things there and kind of combining them. So yeah, when it comes to craft books, I love, kind of like you said, I love reading them and taking what works for me and leaving the rest behind.
Right, right. And then there's sometimes parts, or do you ever find that there's times where maybe you write a particular kind of book and they've said something, you didn't use it readily, but then you kind of like, you know, maybe a new story, or maybe sometimes you're writing something concurrently and you're like, let me just pull this tool out for a moment and see if that works. You know, did that ever happen for you?
Yeah, I think, especially when I'm changing, either genres or age categories, there are some things that just work better in middle grade. There are some things that work better if I'm writing YA. There are things that work better that don't work at all for things like picture books, or, you know, so it's kind of like having this building a toolkit of things that you as a writer can use, depending on what situation you're in, I think is really helpful. And so I feel like the outline, the bullet point kind of outline that I use for my YA is really helpful. I need more of a structured chapter by chapter outline for my middle grade. I don't know why, that's just kind of what works for me. And I think the three-act structure for my YA works really nicely, but I also really love a five-act structure. So yeah, it's all just about kind of what works for you.
Okay, awesome, awesome. So I also wanted to ask about, so you said earlier that you start with the kind of the world and the cool what ifs, which that's my number one thing. Like, if people are, well, where do you get story ideas? Like, you can what if anything, really. Like, there's the story. I mean, I do remember a time where I was also kind of like, oh, where's the story ideas? But then I don't know, something cracked in my head and I was like, oh, everything's a story idea. You
right.
know? but when it comes to, like, around what point in the process, I guess this is still obviously in the early, before drafting stages, what point in the process do you find yourself deciding who the characters are what they're going to be like, and how do you decide what best fits the story, or what characters best fit the story you're trying to tell?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I think that sometimes we have this idea that characters kind of pop into your head and they're fully formed and they're present and they're telling you where to go and what to do and how they're going to navigate. And it doesn't always work that way. So like for me, the world will be there first, and then I will look at that world kind of decide, you know, who is the best person to kind of take us through this situation, through the way this world works. And I really try to have that main character be someone who kind of challenges the established views that I kind of set up in this world building process. But it takes me a solid draft to really know my characters.
Right.
It's the writing process can be about discovery. Even if you have an outline, it can still be about learning who your characters are and what they want and what kind of situations, you know, pop up for them. So it takes me a solid draft to learn who they are. And then that first pass after that is is where things really start to pick up and the characters really start to come alive for me.
Right, right. Yeah, I do feel like you get to know your characters as you write them. You know, it's almost like it's almost like a conversation. You know, you're constantly talking back and forth, especially in the second draft stages, really. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, because you're going back through them and you know them better when you're going through them again. And you're like, this isn't them. And they're telling you, yeah, this is me. So you kind of get that kind of a feeling. But yeah, I love pretty much all the characters in this Poison Heart, the duo. I'm trying to think of maybe who my favorite is. I guess I could be easy and say it's Briseis, but I really do like, I'm blanking on her name.
Marie,
yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
I'm bad with things.
Oh, no, it's fine. No, and I, you know, funny enough, like one of my favorite characters in this Poison Heart is actually Carter. He really was a fun character to write. And even though he does some questionable things, he's just I think he's just a really great kind of counter to Briseis and Marie, because he's kind of opposite, but he's, he's a complicated character, and he has a really complicated relationship with his mom and his whole situation. So it really is, it's really fun to write characters who kind of toe the line between, are they good guys? Are they bad guys? Are they somewhere in between? Those characters are always the most fun to write for me.
Yeah, I do like the nuances. And Carter, the nuance is really good. He clearly, very clearly needs like a real friend. And then he's kind of is set on the, it's one of those things when you think about, you know, it's easy, like when you're online, for example, you see somebody and they say something like negative or whatever, and you write them off, which I don't really blame people for writing somebody off online. Like, it is what it is. It's online, you know. but it's easier to write them off. But there is probably, in most cases, not everybody, there are just internet trolls, but in most cases there are people, even though they view something like is probably wholly wrong or just opposite of you, there is probably something behind that. Like something, either they were raised into that, their ideology was built by what they were around. And in Carter's case, look who his mom is.
There's, you know, it's kind of like you were saying, the environment that you come from, you know, plays such a huge part in who you might become. And I think when you're a teenager and, you know, you have this this kind of authority figure who treats you the way that his mother treats him, it's kind of like, how do you come out of that a whole person? How do you come out of that being able to have established relationships and friendships with other people in a healthy kind of way? And it's damn near impossible. And it's really difficult.
And what I like about him is that he does repeatedly, he apologizes a lot. He did some things that were really bad and he apologizes, but you can't apologize for that. But he does try to like you know, like, you know, don't come this way. You're going to get hurt. I'm trying to help you. Okay, you're going to come this way anyway. Okay, let me give you some tips then, I guess. He's like right. So like in between.
Yeah, he's very torn between the loyalty that he feels like he should have for his mother, mm-hmm. and the kind of budding friendship that he has with Perseus. He really is conflicted about it, and I think that makes him a great character, a great, you know, supporting character. He really has these challenges, and it is really mm-hmm. hard for him, and I think that makes him very interesting.
Right. And while we're talking about character a little bit, I also want to talk about, so like, it's clear, so like Briseis is like a clear protagonist in Celine and names, Lord have mercy. but you have the characters who are kind of the clear good guys or protagonists. And then you have like these characters that are, I'm trying to say this in a way that doesn't like spoil exactly what's going on. So, like, you have these higher beings, right, who mm-hmm. are not necessarily antagonistic or protagonistic.
Right.
They kind of just are what they are. And right. I really liked that. I liked that there was a very clear, I'm not really for or against you. It just is what it is kind of a thing about a lot of those characters. How did you kind of, you know, I don't want to say balance them, but how did you kind of, maybe balance is the right word. How did you kind of balance that personality within those characters? Again, I'm being vague about what they are, but.
Yeah, I think for me, it was important that they feel kind of detached from the main kind of plot. They are hugely involved, obviously,
right,
but having them be just kind of the way they are, where this has been the way that they've done things for forever. Mm-hmm. And right. So they do have this very kind of detached feeling, but I wanted it to be, it had to be that way, because otherwise they could have stepped in at any point in time and they didn't. And for me, that right. just doesn't seem like, that wasn't something that I wanted to have happen. I didn't want an easy save for this. And I feel like it's frustrating for Briseis and Marie and other characters that are involved there, because of how kind of hands off these other beings are. And it's frustrating for them. But I think that these other characters are kind of doing their best. And I think we see that a lot in book two in This Wicked Fate, with the kind of situation that ends up there. You get to see how these beings maybe are a little jealous of human beings, and
right,
the
right.
way we get to kind of live and be vulnerable and be fragile and you know, because our lives are so short in their eyes, it makes it very precious. And so, mm-hmm. So I think having that other kind of point of view is it was a challenge, but I think it really adds to the dynamic of the storytelling.
Yeah. I think you did accomplish that, like in terms of like them feeling detached. They didn't feel like too good or too bad. They just mm-hmm. felt like, this is what I am. And they're established in what they are. And then I do also like, you know, using Briseis is like a means to kind of tell them about themselves at mm-hmm. some points, you know. It's like, well, why are you even here then? You know?
Like, right.
Like, if you didn't care so much, then why are you talking to me? Why are you even right. giving me this information or what have you?
Right. She has the important questions. She's right. like, why even bother? You know, mm-hmm. so yeah.
Yeah. And those seem to be the kind of questions that they may not expect somebody to ask them, because it's like, look who you're talking to. Like,
right. Yeah.
Right. So when someone does ask them, they kind of have to look in on themselves and say, you know, ask themselves the same question. So right. yeah, I like that. But yeah. Okay. So again, we're still kind of, I know I keep talking about like the prep for the writing the story, but a lot of that is so important when it comes to making a story work. And let's be real, a lot of people do linger in at the before the actual writing of chapters process. And I think knowing what that process looks like for different people can be helpful in terms of, like, you know, getting a story out or getting to the chapter process. But my question was about the research. So it's no secret this Poison Heart is heavily plant life influenced, right? it's kind of like there's a little bit of poison ivy ish kind of vibes going on, even though Briseis is nothing like Pamela Isley at all. She's her own character, and I like that take too. I like that. I mean, how many plant based like characters are out there, you know, like,
right? Not many.
right. There's very few. So it's cool. Like, just talking about perspective, it's cool to like have this completely new character who has this set of abilities, and the set of abilities doesn't work exactly. Like it's not exactly Poison Ivy, you know. I mean, that's a right. good, you know, I guess Mira to put to her, but it's not. They're not exactly like that. It's a little different. It responds to her. It responds to her, I guess, based on how free she's feeling, like how whether she lets go or whether she's like trying to compress her abilities.
Right. Yeah. It was really important for me to have her kind of these kind of abilities that she has. It was important for those to mirror how she was feeling inside, and mm-hmm. the overall kind of point is that, you know, when we try to kind of suppress who we are, it can make things harder for us. We're not truly kind of happy and whole unless we are our whole authentic selves. And for her, kind of trying to suppress these things and not, you know, not have these things pop up when she's out in public, and it's so stressful for her. So I think that was a really, that was something that I really leaned into, was just making sure that those powers were really connected to something emotional and something, you know, that was inside Briseis.
Right. Yeah. And kind of like that, milieu, for lack of a better word, of walking into this outside of the city over into like this countryside place where there's, you know, I think there's a line earlier on where I think Mo mentions or something like that, that there's, hey, there's, Are you going to be okay? There's trees everywhere. and I kind of like that she gets out there and then she realizes, like, oh, I get to just be, you know, I don't have to worry. And even with Carter, when she reveals, you know, to Carter what she could do, it's kind of like, that's also why it's so hurtful when Carter does what he does. Because it's like, I'm trying to be free, and I'm experiencing like just being me. And then I get kind of, you know, you do this to me. So
I wrote him, but I still am just like, how dare you? But
yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. I was kind of feeling like that too. I was like, man, y'all went to the movies and we're hanging out.
Right.
I never got around to the question. Talking about her abilities and how cool that is. I kind of got stuck on that for a moment because I love seeing the different perspectives, because everybody does picture, I mean, I love Poison Ivy too, but like everybody pictures her as, you know, the plant lady or whatever. And I'm just like, well, here's a different picture of what this person could look like. I mean, like, I'm all for a magical black girl. So I'm like, all right, we now have a different image. And then not just Briseis herself, like the whole cast. I mean, the whole cast is, if I'm not mistaken, is everybody, I believe everybody's black or brown,
yep,
at least?
Yep. Everybody. It's funny because it's such a point of pride for me to be able to write this story that is just peopled with black families and black friendships. Right. And we have all of these different, relationships and all of these different people, because we are not a monolith, and it's important to be able to see all these different facets of our lives. And so it really is a huge point of pride for me to have an all black cast.
Right. Yeah, yeah. It was great. And what I liked feeling, so after you're so far into the story, I like, so this is where I feel like writing should get to in terms of like diverse perspectives and culture in general. There's a certain point in the book, and I felt like this when I was reading some N.K. Jemisin stuff too. There's a certain point in this book where I don't even think about, like, if the character is white, I know that they're black.
Right.
It's not even right. Like, even when they show up before the description even comes up or anything like that, you know, and you're thinking of sometimes some of these characters being historically white, you know, speaking of the entities that I'm trying not to name.
Yeah.
But I mean, we already talked about the fact there's Greek mythology, but yeah. Mm-hmm. So some of these beings show up and they're historically white, but when they show up, I know by default, like, I don't have to think about it. Like, that they're black, or at mm-hmm. least I think they all are, but yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. So I really like that feeling, because so often in the past I've read stories and when a character shows up, I assume that they're white until otherwise stated.
Sure. You know? Because that's what we've been shown. That's what publishing has kind of taught us to expect. So yeah, I you know, I definitely have had books where I realized that I was reading at kind of like the default was
right.
something else. And mm-hmm. That, you know, it's very freeing to be able to write with the default being what it is for me, which is just mm-hmm. about black families and relationships right. and just about community. Mm-hmm. Having that as the default for me is, I don't even think about it. Right. But I do hear from readers and, you know, other people who are, you know, kind of consuming the story, and you know, there's some surprise there, or sometimes there's confusion, and I'm like, it's gonna be okay. Like, right. I made my way through books with all white casts my entire mm-hmm. life. Like, right, it will be right. okay. Yeah,
mm-hmm. yeah, exactly. And I think I think it's okay that, you know, whether you chose to make the character, like, characters all different colors, or you made them all black the way you did. I don't think that there is a rule to it. I mean, mm-hmm. my personal rule is I would like to stop reading books that are all white. I don't mind if there's white characters, obviously.
Sure, but
but I would like to not read books where every single character, over time, like, I've seen things getting better, you know. There's still a ways to go, but it's most visual in movies. I mean, I can't speak for all books. Sometimes books are kind of vague about description, sometimes that's fine. But on TV, I have been seeing more, at least in the last 5 to 10 years, I've been seeing, like, more diverse stuff, and I'm glad to see that, you know.
Yeah.
But it's really cool to be reading through the story and knowing that this character is, you know, this character yes. is black. And so to see all the gods and goddesses of these guys, especially when later on, when I'll just mention this one name, when Persephone shows yeah. up, that was like, I don't know, that was like the big cap, you know, that was
yeah. Like, yeah. I just remember, you know, I'm a huge Percy Jackson fan. I'm an 80s baby, so I had Hercules, like the Disney Hercules, and it's like, you know, you yeah. love these stories, right? But you just they could be anything. They could be mm-hmm. anything, and they're never black. So,
right, right.
Like, let's just do that. Why not? You know,
yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And of course, it's not just painting the roses red. It comes with lots of other, yeah. you know, nuance. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's been fun. It's been a fun kind of thing to do.
Right. And I also think seeing that kind of diversity in media allows us to do what, like, you did. So I think about, like, so your books, and then, and then people like what Jordan Peele does in his movies and stuff like that. So when mm-hmm. when you have a wide range of people, and there isn't, like, just a default, or the default is something different than what you're seeing, then you could do other things. Like, it's no longer taboo to have a black villain, for example. That it should mm-hmm. be normal to have a black villain in a book. You know, the reason why that it was bad in the past, or seen as bad in the past, is because the default was white, so everybody would be white, and then you bring in the black villain, you know?
Right, the only person who was bad would be the black character.
Exactly,
right,
but if you are properly distributing these characters, and you're doing diversity properly, then it makes sense that, you know, like, you know, you have Carter and his mom, they're like these very nuanced kind of characters, you know? You can't do that in a book where the default is white, because it's not going to work for obvious reasons. So it's refreshing to see that. So I think about that, like, in your book, in Jordan Peele stuff, like, we could have black villains and it not be like a big deal. You know what I mean?
Right. And I'm a huge fan of Jordan Peele. I'm a huge fan of horror in general, which I think is another space where, you know, being black in a horror novel or a horror movie has historically meant that we are the first to die. We are the, you know, we are the ones who kind of get offered up, you know, sacrificed first. It's, you know, mm-hmm. it's kind of like, there's so much more that you can do in that space.
Right.
And there's so much more that we should be allowed to do in that space. And so, yeah, there has been a lot of progress. We're still moving forward on that. We still got a ways to go.
Still working through it.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, a movie will pop up on Netflix, and I'm like, it's 2023. Yeah. but they're figuring it out. Hollywood. I just call it Hollywood. I don't know
right.
who they are. But yeah, the but industry.
Them. Yeah, is they. It out. Yes.
Okay, I was rambling a little bit about, you know, diversity, just loving seeing diverse things in books, especially since that, as a writer, it should be more interesting, you know, whether you're a white writer or whatever your background of writing is, to explore other cultures, because isn't that stunting your own writing if you're like doing one culture? I mean,
right. You want to, you know, I hope that, that people are, kind of looking to the work as a space to reflect their lived experiences. You know, I don't think that the first black person you've ever met should be a character that you are writing in your book. Like, I think you should definitely be like trying to do better, you know, in your regular life, because I do think that sometimes people look for a checkbox on diversity.
Yes. Yes.
Like, let me add a black character so that I can, you know, get in on this trend, or that I can, you know, I can expand my readership maybe to people that I wasn't even thinking about before. Like, that's when it kind of becomes a problem.
Right.
But I'm encouraged by the work that black authors and other non-black people of color are doing, especially in the YA space and the middle grade space. I think it's, I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. But yeah, so I wanted to ask really quick about, because I got so far away from it. go back to ask you. Okay, so the research process. When it comes to, like, did you become a botanist or?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I could like pass that test, whatever that is.
Right.
I did so much. I knew that in order to make the story feel authentic to the readers, that I was going to have to do more than just kind of vaguely describe things, or, you know, I did a ton of research before and during the drafting process for This Poison Heart and This Wicked Fate. So the research process for me involved just reading a ton of books about botany, about just all kinds of plants in general, especially poisonous plants. I was very deep in the research about that. And then also I did a lot of research into the practice of like folk magic, especially, and how that ties into our ancestry and our culture. Because there is this very, my dad's family is from Birmingham, Alabama. There's a culture there of using plants as medicine, is using plants in folk magic. And so bringing those things together was really important for me. So I did a ton of research into all of those things. And the research process, it was pretty intense, but you can get stuck there. It's easy to get stuck in the research and feeling like, okay, I don't have enough to like move forward with the story. You have to kind of gather. And that's why I'm a huge fan of doing research during the drafting process as well, because it makes it feel like you're making progress and you're still researching, but you're not stalled in your writing process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's definitely been certain points where I realized that, okay, if I try to tell myself I need to know everything about this before I start writing, I'll never start writing.
You know?
And I know that sometimes when I'm in the process of writing, if I'm stuck on chapter four, and in chapter four, I have to introduce some, I don't know, just a poisonous plant that I can't think of right now, then I could put a checkbox, or I could put on my to-do list, hey, I need to, in order to finish chapter four, the under chapter four, research X plant. I mean, I'm probably a bad example, but you know.
that's how it works. Yeah. It's kind of like you can also, I think something that I kind of, you know, I got so caught up in trying to find these plants that had these very specific attributes that I was like, I am a fiction writer. I can literally, you know, I can take the base of this, you know, this plant that is a real thing and I can add onto it. I can embellish, I can, you know, I can make something up that fits exactly what I need. And so that too. So it's kind of bringing those two things together, not being so stuck in the research that you kind of get away from the creative process.
Right, right. Yeah, I like that. Yeah. And I think that's something also to remember is that, hey, if your genre is fiction, you can branch out and do something, you know, do some fiction. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that being said, there's a lot of mythology in the story as well. So there's research, obviously, with plant life. There's some plants that are definitely some made up. I hope they're made up. My God.
Yeah.
Some of them. And then there's the takes on story, like mythology that we know, and then like twists on that mythology. So can you talk a little bit about how you settled upon, I guess, Medea and... Oh my goodness.
And Hecate.
There you go. Hecate. Yeah. Yes. She was in my head and I was like,
yeah. I come from a musical theater background. And so, Medea's story, that opera is, I knew it. I was familiar with it. I also think that just kind of, as a wider kind of, when we hear about Medea and we know that we're talking about mythology, it is this very classic story of a woman scorned, who does something terrible. And, you know, it's a prominent story. In my research process, what I found out was that there were other versions of the Medea story that existed before the one that we are familiar with. And in those versions, she does not kill her children. In one version, she puts them into a temple and the temple collapses. And then in another version, it is kind of the villagers who murder the children and not her. I just find I find it funny that the one version of the story that we have kind of brought into the present day with us is the one where she is portrayed in the worst light imaginable.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so knowing that, I really wanted to give that character a chance to be something else, someone who was flawed, but whose real story was waiting to be told. And then with the Hecate mythology, that was a whole nother kind of research thing, because she's not quite as well known as some of the other names and figures that we are familiar with from Greek mythology. And what I found out through my research was that her mythology was kind of shoehorned into the mythology that came later. So her story was probably adapted from some other culture that was, you know, being conquered and colonized, you know, at the time. Probably something from North Africa. There's some research to suggest that story has roots there. And so it made sense to me that somewhere along the line there was going to be a story that centered a Black woman. And so I wanted to bring those stories together. I wanted to have some other perspective, and kind of realize that when we hear these stories about villainous women, that we need to ask who is telling the story.
Right. Yeah. I really love that, because everybody in the story, up until they find out, oh, there's a different story here, including Briseis, they're all kind of like, this is the story of the woman who, yeah, we know that story. Yeah. And then they go do the research and they're like, oh, wait, that's not what happened.
Right. And it's funny because then also some of the stories that Briseis is familiar with that are about, like, Hercules, like, she thinks story is fine and funny and great. And then she finds out the truth and it's like, wait, what? Like, he did what? So it's funny to kind of have that dynamic there, whether you're kind of finding out the truth about these things and what that looks like. And yeah, it's fun.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that there's a power in revelation in storytelling too. There's a power in using what, you know, putting it in front with, you know, the reader knows, giving them information. We know that there's a girl who has plant power. We know nothing else about her. She lives in New York. That's it. And I think that's what makes the story so cool. That's why I love these kinds of stories so much, because it's like, here's the facts. And the first few chapters are all about, you know, she's in a room, she's practicing with poison, and she's like, I'm anti-poison, okay. I'm immune. And then so you discover all these things, and then you discover what you think you know.
Right.
And then as the story goes on, like, peeling back the layers more and more and more, there's a skill to that. Earlier in the story, like, how many of the details did you know early? Did you know most of it early and you knew how to peel it back, or did you get some of them as you went?
I did. I feel like I had most of them from the beginning. But there were things that I learned along the way, which is kind of like we were saying, like, writing can be about discovery. I did discover some things along the way, but I had the basic kind of beats at the very beginning, just so that I would, it worked out that way. It doesn't always work out that way for me, but right, with this story, they were there at the beginning, and I kind of had to figure out a way to just slowly reveal this information, but also reveal the real information and the fake information, and kind of balancing all of that. And I think I think that skill that I'm still, trying to perfect comes from my love of mysteries, reading mysteries and having the information just revealed to you in a certain way. I think that's where that comes from for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I think what's done really well too is, so, like, one of the hardest things are the first few chapters of a book, especially the first chapter, because a reader, I mean, I don't want to, like, blame the age of Netflix, but it's not Netflix's fault. But, you know, people want to get to the point fast, or they at least want to be drawn in fast. So your job very early is to get people kind of invested somewhat in the story quickly. I liked at the beginning of the story, it's like, I don't know, maybe the first couple of paragraphs, she's got plant powers, like, instantly. I mean, you know it when you look at the cover, but it's like, we don't, like, play hide the ball with it for, like, you know, several chapters. It's kind of like instant. And then we're already getting into interesting things, like, okay, she's got these the plants just they just lean towards her everywhere she walks. How does she deal with that? You know, do her friends know? Then you find out her friends kind of know, but they don't really talk about it.
Right.
So it's like, so now we're, like, very quickly already interested in, like how do you navigate life like this? You know what I mean? And then you find out that she is more or less comfortable with it. Well, she's comfortable, but she's not comfortable. Like, she's comfortable with herself and her abilities, it seems like, but maybe not with, like, the way society responds to her abilities,
right?
You know,
right. And I think that's kind of another layer to the story, is kind of, you know, who you are versus what kind of your community and your friends and your family, who they want you to be, and who, you know, who ultimately you become because of your own choices. And so it's kind of like Girl with Plant Powers and, you know, Greek mythology and poison plants, but there's also a really human element that runs through it.
Right. Right. And that theme is that elusive thing I've talked about so many times on this podcast and during writer chats and stuff, that it seems so hard to grasp sometimes, but I think when you know your theme, and sometimes you don't know it, like when you first start writing it, sometimes it comes, like, as you go, you're like, oh, well, maybe it's about this. And then, like, sometimes when you're editing or whatever, you kind of pour that theme more into the background and you lean things more in that direction. So that thing that you mentioned earlier of kind of being comfortable with herself and then being allowing herself to be free with the, you know, with her abilities and who she is. I really like that. I think it's just a really good job with just like everything seems really tight. I don't really see like any like loose ends where I'm kind of like, oh, that didn't fit together for me. Or there's this other question, and you start introducing the questions early.
Right. For my own sanity, because otherwise it's like, this is, I know there's something that I left out or that is, you know, that's not answered the way I wanted it to be, but you know, that's how it works sometimes. But yeah, I think it's helpful to start asking those questions early on and to start kind of working through the process of revealing that information, because you don't want to just, for me, I don't find it, I don't think it's fun to just have the information kind of handed to you. I want to be able to kind of piece it together myself and figure it out. And people are like, oh, some people will be like, oh, I was able to guess what was going to happen. And I was like, well, that means that I laid the right. you know, the reveals out properly and I did my job. So that's okay.
Right.
And then other people who are like blindsided by what ends up happening, they go back and reread and say, oh, you know, okay, the clues were there. So it's always just kind of fun hearing from readers.
And I think as writers, knowing how to kind of lay the groundwork, how to know information yourself, but then reveal it, like pace the revelations out throughout the story. That's a difficult skill, but I think just taking your time with it and drafting and redraft, like I always tell people, that you have the power of hindsight when you're writing. Like whatever you wrote in your first draft, the revelation doesn't have to be where you put it. You can move it further back or you can put some foreshadowing earlier on in or whatever. And I think having that power of hindsight is probably one of the best skills to have or best tools to have at your disposal as a writer.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's why I don't rush, but I try to get that first draft down as quickly as possible because I just need it on the page. And then you can go back and you can do so much. You already have something to work with. The page is not blank. You can, you can build things out. That's where the work really shines for me.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah. So the last thing I want to hit on real quick is just this question about, throughout the story, I mean, we've been talking a lot about the process and revelations and theme and, you know, characters and stuff like that. But when it comes to like words on the actual page, there are some moments where, I like stuff that's written beautifully. I think it's written beautifully. I think you did a good job there. I like stuff like as you're reading it, you enjoy the words you're reading, not just what's happening, but like the way it's told, right? And there are some moments where you hit hard. The scene with the certain beings when they're underground, when they come up out of the pool, that was like, I had to like go back. I was like, let me reread that. That's crazy. You know, it's almost horror film. Like, you know, I like stuff like that. And then there's like the scene with, the one thing that sticks out, I don't remember the exact line, but there's a scene that sticks out with Briseis later on, again, to try to be vague about what's going on, later on meets her mom, right? And there's something about the words that you use there to kind of frame that reunion. You know what I mean? Do you have any, again, I don't know the exact words, but do you have any tips on making scenes like that feel present, feel real, feel, you know, like you're in them?
Yeah. I think it comes down to the emotion that you're trying to evoke in the reader, but also that you're trying to convey through the characters. And so there is, it was really important to me during that specific scene that Briseis feels all the weight of everything that she's been through, the grief of, you know, initially thinking, you know, it was over, and then realizing that it's not over, but that the journey is so treacherous that you might not even make it to the end. It had to be visceral for me. So I think in order to kind of convey that on the page, something that has really helped me is reading poetry, because there is something about the cadence and the impact of the words. And we're talking sometimes very, very few words to convey a very powerful message. I think reading poetry and attempting to write poetry, not that it should never be published, it's just for me, has been a good exercise for me in getting those emotional scenes. So when you're tapping into the emotion of that scene, whether it's, you know, in the scene where they're underground, that is fear and that is disbelief. And so kind of distilling that down and using the right words to really make it a very visceral experience. Where you can feel the emotion and you can see the things that are happening. I think that comes from enjoying poetry and from really thinking about the story through the lens of emotions and feelings, not just actions that are happening on the page.
Right. Yeah. And that's one of the my favorite things about writing. Like, I mean, I'm always thinking about, like, you know, before I'm writing, I'm always thinking about well, what's going to happen? Obviously, you know, this got to happen, this got to happen. And then, you know, I want to make people feel this, and I want people to be sad about this or scared of this or whatever. But then when I'm actually in, like, that's when I'm in there, that's the fun part for me. Actually, hold on. Let me reframe that. Rephrase that. When I'm in there the second time, that's when it's fun for me.
Yeah.
The first time, it's kind of like, oh, this first draft is, But like you said earlier, like, I like the idea of, just do it. Just write it. Just rush through it.
Yeah.
Don't worry about if it's like crap, because most people who think what they write is crap the first time, it doesn't even matter, because it's just the first draft. Like,
right. It truly doesn't matter. That first draft really, I mean, there's writing, whether it's good or bad is completely, a matter of opinion. So
of course, yeah.
So it's like, you know, but I just feel like that first draft it's awful, and that's fine. And I've had to learn to be okay with that, because for me, there was a period of time where I felt like I had to try to get everything right the first time around. Like, I had to try to make it, you know, everything had to pop, everything had to fit together. And that is not what the first draft is for. The first draft is for figuring it out and getting it on the page, and then you can go back and do something with it. So once you kind of free yourself of that kind of expectation that it has to be anything, it's a lot. So many things open up for you as possibilities within your writing.
I profoundly agree with that. Once you get the first draft out the way, yeah, you're on your second or whatever number draft after that. It's a lot, I don't know if the word's funner, but like, I like the process a lot more, like when I'm going back over something, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just got to do the hard stuff first, you know. The hard stuff is the first draft. I definitely appreciate the conversation. I definitely appreciate you imparting your knowledge and your experience with writing and sharing some of your process. Like, it's been helpful to me to hear.
Okay, good.
right. I'm sure I'd be helpful to other people. I hope other people realize, hey, look, you can write whatever you want. You can change whatever mythologies you want. You can make all your characters black if you want.
you can do anything. Yes. Right. Do not limit yourself. Yeah.
Do you want to give, are there any words of inspiration or encouragement that you'd like to give writers out there?
I think the main thing is that, especially for my fellow kind of, creators who come from, you know, intersectional, marginalized backgrounds, it's a really scary kind of time in the book world right now. There's a lot of book banning. There's a lot of rhetoric. It can feel very overwhelming when you have this story that you really want to tell and you see all of these things happening. It can be intimidating and overwhelming. And so the main thing that I would like to say is just that the world really needs your stories, and that the readers, especially if you're writing for kids, mm-hmm. They really, really need these stories. So please write the story that you want to tell, and be an advocate for yourself and your community, because the readers, especially the young readers, really need those stories.
Right. Absolutely. Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you so much. Real quick, social media, let people know, first of all, anything that's coming out soon, anything people could expect from you, that you're allowed to tell them, and then where they can find you on social media.
Yeah. So my most recent, book just came out, last week. It is called My Dear Henry. It is a Jekyll and Hyde retelling for the Remixed Classics series. So that's out now. Everywhere books are sold. And then my next project is my YA horror novel, which comes out in the summertime. It's called You're Not Supposed to Die Tonight. It is a scary story inspired by my love of 80s slasher horror films. So that is what I have coming up. And then I'm on social media, mostly Twitter and Instagram, at Kaylin Bayron on both of those. I also do TikTok, but I'm not good at it, so right. I don't know about that. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm still trying to figure out TikTok.
Yeah.
okay, awesome. Awesome. No, I appreciate you for coming on. Again, everybody else, you can find me on all social media platforms at Fourth Wall. That's IVWALL. You can find the podcast on iTunes, Google, iHeartRadio, wherever you like to listen to your podcast, Spotify. You can find the podcast there. Just look up Beyond the Fourth Wall of Writing. Hopefully this has helped you out. Is like I can't imagine that it wouldn't help others out. It's definitely helped me out. Thanks for listening, and thanks for being with us today, Kaylin.
Thank you for having me.